Well, guys, last week we started a series through the book of Ruth. And I told you last week, Ruth really is quite an incredible Old Testament love story. And honestly, I mean, such a great one. I mean, romance novels today, you know, chick flicks and romantic movies today, this puts them to shame. It really does. Just a really great, solid, authentic love story that we're going to be studying through. But what's great about it is it isn't just a love story where, you know, our hearts go pitter-pat and, oh, isn't that sweet. It is a picture of God that we see in this book. And we'll be pointing that out, of course, over the next few weeks. However, one of the problems with studying a book like Ruth is that everything that came before, everything builds on what came previously. Okay, so if you weren't here last week when we began in chapter 1, you might be at a tiny bit of a disadvantage. Now, I say that knowing that God can do anything he wants to with his word. There's no disadvantage when we're coming to the word. But tonight I'm not really going to have enough time to recap everything that we looked at last week. It's simply too much. It would be half of our time just talking about what we looked at last week. So I kind of encourage you, maybe tomorrow or whenever, maybe listen to last week's sermon. You can just get it on the website, of course, or grab a CD after service from my dad out there, whatever, just for the purpose of kind of catching up a little bit, because it really does set the stage for Ruth chapter 2. But before we jump into it, I do want to remind us of something that we looked at last week, a promise of God that we ended with last week. And this is a promise that the author is basically revealing to us. He's revealing it to us through the story, through the language that he uses, through literary devices, all sorts of things. And it is a promise that is really the heart and soul of the book of Ruth. And the promise to us is this, that God, in his sovereign design, ordains sorrowful, difficult, sometimes horrible tragedy to set the stage for really surprising triumph. And that is the truth of what we see in this book. And it's the truth that we see elsewhere in Scripture. That in those moments of our lives, in the moments of your life, when it seems to you because of circumstances and what's going on, that God is as far from you as he has ever been, he may just be laying the foundation of a display of the greatest display of his faithfulness to you. And I want us to keep that in mind, okay, as we move through this book, because it's something that we're going to see time and time again. So with that in mind, let's read verse 1 of chapter 2 together. Now, Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth, of the family, or literally the clan, of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. Now, let's just pause there for a second. At the end of chapter 1, we basically have two main characters left. Everybody else has died, right? I mean, it was really kind of a really tough chapter. And the only two that are left are Naomi and Ruth. And basically, they are destitute. They are widowed, childless, with major needs. And I guess at this point in their life, you could kind of sum up their needs by saying they really need two things. They need food. That's pretty practical, right? They need food and they need family. And they have none of the above. And that really is what the rest of this book has to somehow solve. How are they going to be provided for food and with family? And so the author gives us verse 1. And really, if this is a picture here, and I don't think I'm out of turn in saying this, kind of a picture of a knight in shining armor coming on the scene. And there are two important facts here about this guy, Boaz, that are mentioned. First of all, you'll notice it says that he is of the family of, or some of your versions might say, the kinsman of Elimelech. Now, we don't tend to talk that way anymore, but the way that Israelite society worked is that as an individual, right, you were part of a family. That part we get pretty well. But then that family was then part of a clan. And then a number or grouping of clans were then the tribes of Israel. And so, right, that's what you had. You had, you know, individual, then family, then clan, then tribes. And that was kind of the order of things in those days. And the reason this is important is because this clan level that we're talking about was probably one of the most important parts of this structure. And the reason is because if you were part of a clan, it was your responsibility to take care of other members of your clan. When their needs arose, when there was people who were in need and helpless, as part of that clan, it was your duty before God to help them in any way that you can. So this is a significant point that's being made here. It's kind of lost on us, but for the Jews that were reading this, they went, that's interesting. So we find out here that Boaz is in the same clan as Naomi's dead husband, Elimelech. The second fact that we're told here about Boaz is that he is a man of great wealth and a man of great character. And the reason I say that is because the Hebrew word that the author uses here is not just describing Boaz as rich. Now, that's pretty common in our love stories, isn't it? Have you ever noticed that? You ever noticed the knight in shining armor is always incredibly wealthy? I don't know why that is. It kind of rules out all the rest of us. But nonetheless, you know, that part we're used to in a love story. But that's not all that's being said here. What this word means is that Boaz was a man of great weight. Not describing his waistline, obviously. He's a man of standing. He's a man of weight in the community. And so, yes, he is well off financially. He is. But he was also a man of character in the community there. And so here we've got this picture of Boaz. Can you kind of picture him a little bit, right? This knight in shining armor. Now, understand, at verse 1, Boaz hasn't even entered into the scene yet. Okay? I mean, Naomi isn't even aware of Boaz at this point. She isn't necessarily, you know, aware of him. And so we're about to shift back to Ruth and Naomi in verse 2. But what we have in verse 1 is the author kind of heightening the sense of drama, right? And the sense of hope. But at the same time, he's also heightening the reality of the sovereignty of God at work. That God is doing stuff behind the scenes that nobody else at this point has any clue about. Look at verse 2 with me. And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, "Please, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I might find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." Now, again, this is another thing that probably is completely unfamiliar to us in our culture. But what we're seeing right here, guys, is the working out of a plan that God put in place for the Jews. In the book of Leviticus and in the book of Deuteronomy, God had set up in harvest season a means for providing for the poor and the destitute and the foreigner. Those who had no land, those who had no food. And so what God did is he commanded the landowners and the harvesters that during the harvest season, right, when they're out there harvesting all their grain, that they were to leave the corners of their fields unharvested. And while they were harvesting the rest, if at any point they dropped some on the ground, they were not allowed to pick it up. Now, that may sound kind of odd, but basically what that meant then was that others who had no wherewithal, who had no food, who had no ability to take care of themselves at that moment, they could then come behind the harvesters and they could glean from what was left. And of course, in that way, maybe at least for a day, maybe 2 days, they would have enough food to take care of themselves. And I love this. It might just sound like, well, it's just kind of a nice practical welfare system, you know, for the Jews. But you know what it really is? It is a picture of the heart of God for those who are poor, for those who have nothing, for those who are foreigners and outcasts and have no ability to care for themselves. God is saying, I love them. And so I'm going to give you some specific directions on how to treat them at this time. And so this law of God is now coming to the aid of Ruth and Naomi. See, that's what Ruth is talking about here. And so Ruth says, I'm going to go out, right? And I'm going to find a landowner or a harvester who one, is following God's command. And second of all, you notice she said, who will grant me favor. Now, that may sound odd to us, knowing that God has already said this is what you're supposed to do, right? But you got to understand who Ruth is. Remember, she is a Moabite woman. And the Jews, as we talked about a lot last week, did not, with good reason, like the Moabites. Very suspicious of them. And so not only did she have to find a field where someone was obeying the law of God about gleaning, but someone who would also be willing to let a Moabite, of all people, come behind and at least get a little bit of grain. I mean, that's all Ruth's looking for. She's just looking for a little bit of food that might last Naomi and her, you know, a day or two, just enough to get them by. And this is where it gets really good. I'm sorry. I love this story. But this is where it gets really good. Look at verse 3 with me. I love this verse. So she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who, just in case you forgot, was of the family of Elimelech. What an amazing coincidence this is. I love that little phrase right there, the NASB. And she happened to come to. Some of your versions might put, as it turned out, right? And you know what it says in the Hebrew, literally? It says, as chance. Now that sounds kind of odd to us, but it's the same thing as us saying, hey, you know what? As luck would have it, this happened. And so as luck would have it, she just happened, right, to go in the middle of all of these fields surrounding Bethlehem in Judah. She just happened in the middle of all of those to find herself in, and who would have thought, in the field belonging to who? To Boaz. Now guys, hold on to this truth. There is a truth that the author here is very subtly reminding us of. Nothing happens by accident in the economy of God. Nothing. Nothing happens by accident. Everything happens by appointment. We are not driven. We are not caught up by some blind, impersonal force of chance or coincidence. There is a sovereign God. A powerful God. There is a faithful God who is always orchestrating events on behalf of His children, both for their good and for His glory. I think we just kind of sang something to that effect. I mean, I can quite literally tell you, and you're more than welcome to come after service and ask me what I'm talking about. I won't take up the time here. But I can quite literally tell you that every good thing in my life, everything that I have that is of worth, has come about because, unbeknownst to me, sometimes even while I was in rebellion against the Lord, God was divinely orchestrating events in the background of my life. And I want you guys to grab onto that. I really want you to ponder that, because it is true for you as well as a child of God. There is nothing that has happened to you in this past week, in this past month, in the past decade that is accidental. At no point did God lose track of you, wonder where you were at, you know, and you stumbled into some horrible circumstances and God's wondering where you were. That never happens. A loving, faithful, and sovereign God is divinely orchestrating the events of your life for your good and for His glory. And that is what's happening right here in this book of Ruth. And this is incredible stuff. It gets even better in verse 4. Look at verse 4 with me. I love the way the author puts this. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. Think about that. Say that with me again. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. It's too much, right? I mean, think about it. So Ruth just happened to come into Boaz's field. And when she got there, you'll never guess who just happened to show up at just that time. Yeah. Have you ever been watching, you know, some, you know, sappy movie, maybe with your wife or whatever, some, you know, one of those sorts of movies, and you're just sitting there and you're watching and you're going, oh, come on. There is no way that ever happens in real life. You know, I mean, the details of life, they just don't work like that. And you're about to turn it off and turn to her and tell her how dumb this is. You know what I'm talking about? And you turn to your wife, and what's she doing? She either has a grin from ear to ear, or she's sobbing as she looks at this and says, it's so beautiful, and it's so wonderful, and this almost never happens. And so you just kind of shut up, hopefully, and let things go on. And you're thinking in your head, but it doesn't work like that. Life isn't that way. But guys, guess what? It does work that way. It does work that way under a sovereign God. Continue with me there in verse 4. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, these are his employees, may the Lord be with you. And they said to him, may the Lord bless you. This is a pretty great work environment, right? I mean, this is pretty good. Then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? Now, you could easily miss this, but in the original Hebrew, that basically reads like this. Then Boaz said, whoa, check her out. That's basically what it is. I mean, that's really what's happening here. She caught his eye, okay? Remember, there's dozens and dozens of people out here, and she catches his eye. Now, I'm kidding, of course, but of all those people, he sees her. Now, I want you to notice that he doesn't say, who is that? Or what's her name? He says, whose young woman is this? In other words, what he's asking is, to whom does she belong? What clan is she part of? Is what Boaz is asking. And this, once again, is intended by the author to set off this tension that runs throughout the book of Ruth. You see, because Ruth is a Moabite daughter-in-law with no husband, quite literally, she has zero clan. She has nothing. She doesn't even have that bit of protection that Naomi enjoys. As I mentioned before, Ruth is not just in need of food. What's she in need of? She's in need of family. And that is exactly how the foreman, because that's what this guy is, replies in verse 6. Look at that with me. The servant in charge of the reapers replied, she is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab. And here the author is making us confront that again, right? Just like he did in verse 2. Ruth the Moabitess. Ruth from Moab. We're never allowed to forget that because it is really important. We would forget it, guys. It's real easy to read this and you just completely forget where Ruth's from and who she is. We just think, oh, it's just another girl, you know? And that's not true. So the author is making sure we remember. And of course, he says, this young Moabite woman who returned from Naomi from the land of Moab. So what's the emphasis here? She's not from around here, right? She's not from around here. And in verse 7, the foreman then fills Boaz in on what Ruth had said to the foreman earlier. Look at verse 7. And she said, "Please, let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves." Thus she came and has remained from the morning until now, and she has been sitting in the house for a little while. They would build these little structures, sometimes temporary ones, where they could get out of the sun for a period of time. And she was resting. I guess she was on her break. She was resting in this shaded area. And so Boaz gets filled in a little bit on what's happening and immediately thinks to himself, "Well, I'm going to go talk to her." All right? That's what a guy would do, right? "I'm going to go talk to this girl." And so he makes a beeline for Ruth. Now, to us, that just seems like what you're supposed to do if you're a guy and you find a girl interesting. But actually, this is incredibly surprising. This wealthy, respected Israelite landowner who is on the, probably at the very top of the social ladder, is now going directly to the Moabite woman, foreigner, in his field. This woman who was one step below the lowest rung on the social ladder. And listen to what he says to her, beginning there in verse 8. "Then Boaz said to Ruth, 'Listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go on from this one, but stay here with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. When you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw.'" Now, how's that for an Old Testament pickup line? Yeah, I know. It's a pretty lousy pickup line, actually. But when you think about it, this is quite incredible what Boaz is saying to Ruth. First of all, he uses a term of endearment. What does he call her? They say, "You Moabitess, you pagan woman, hey you." No, none of that. He says, "My daughter." And it was a term of endearment showing that you care about somebody. And he says, "Listen carefully to me." And he says to her, in fact, you notice he repeats himself a few times. He says, "Don't go in another field. Don't go away from here. Stay right here. You'll be provided for in this field and you'll be protected in this field." You see, it was quite common, apparently, in that day for women, particularly foreigners, to be abused or mistreated or at least insulted in some way when they were out in the fields. And so Boaz says, "I'll protect you here. You'll be protected." And then he continues and he says, "And by the way, whenever you're thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars over here that my men have filled." Now, I can tell by your expressions that you are not Jews from around 1300 BC. Because if you were ancient Jews, what I just read, your jaw would have dropped to the ground. You would be in shock. This is shocking. It's even a little bit scandalous what is happening here. Because Boaz is basically crossing all kinds of social and, in some people's minds, moral boundaries to go to this Moabite woman and reach out to her like this. And he says to her, "You can drink from these jars." Now understand, in this diamond, in this day and age, foreigners were the ones who filled the water jugs for the Israelites to drink from. And it was a time when the women were the ones who filled the water jugs for the men to drink from. And so what you've got here is Israelite men filling jars with water for a Moabite woman to drink from. And as I said, if you were an ancient Jew in Bethlehem at this time, you would have been shocked by this behavior. Which is why we're not terribly surprised when we get to verse 10. You see, for us, if we were just reading this without any background at all, we would read verse 10 and we might very well think, you know what? Sure seems like Ruth is overreacting here. I'm sure just a nice thank you would have sufficed. But it actually makes total sense considering what in light of what just happened. Look at verse 10. "Then Ruth fell on her face, bowing to the ground." This is an Old Testament word for worship here. And she said to him, "Why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner?" And guys, that really is the question of the chapter here. It's set up right at the very beginning, right, that Ruth is in need of someone to show her favor. And here she's sitting shocked. She can't believe it. Why have you shown me such favor? I'm not deserving of this. Have you not noticed who I am? I'm a foreigner. And I'm not just a foreigner. I'm a Moabite. I'm not just a Moabite. I'm a Moabite woman. And you know our history. Why have you shown such mercy to me? And that question begins this beautiful dialogue between Ruth and Boaz. And Boaz's words to Ruth and her response to him is just this majestic, poetic language that really gives us such a beautiful picture of love and mercy and blessing. You see that picture beginning there in verse 11. Boaz replied to her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me. And how you left your father and your mother and the land of your birth and came to a people you did not previously know. May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge." This is beautiful, isn't it? It really is. And I got to think, it doesn't say it, but you got to think that Ruth at this point is just kind of swooning a little bit. I mean, this really is quite incredible. I mean, Boaz is saying, "Ruth, you have planted your life under the Lord God of Israel. And despite your past and despite your heritage and despite your station in life, you have taken refuge under the wings of the Almighty God of Israel." And look at how Ruth responds in verse 13. Then she said, "I have found favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and indeed have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants." Basically, what Ruth is saying is, look, even though I know I'm on the lowest rung of the social ladder, you have comforted my heart. You have spoken to my soul. I mean, these are similar to the kinds of words that we saw last week in chapter 1, verses 16 and 17. Remember when Ruth was committing herself to Naomi. And she said, "I will not leave you." Back then, remember Naomi? She was left speechless by what was said to her. And we kind of see the same thing happen here between verses 13 and 14. There's kind of a pregnant pause here, so to speak, as the author kind of pauses a little bit and Boaz is basically left speechless, which sets the stage for verse 14. Look at that with me. There's been some time that has passed here during the day, and then it says in verse 14, "At mealtime, Boaz said to her, 'Come here, that you may eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar.'" It's not just vinegar. That sounds kind of gross to us. But it was a wine vinegar. Think Carrabba's or Macaroni Grill. You know what they put on the table? That's what we're talking, okay? "Dip your bread in the vinegar." So she sat beside the reapers and he served her roasted grain. And she ate and was satisfied and had some left over. Now here, well, quite honestly, this is Ruth and Boaz's first date. Okay? That's kind of, right? That's just a nice romantic meal over some roasted grain. And you really can't beat the drama right here. And understand, this is not just a meal. Okay? Jews did not look at meals the way we do, right? Well, let's just eat and move on our way. No, it was something important. It was a moment of fellowship. And that's what's happening here. This is deeper. There's a symbol in this, a picture of fellowship, not just being there. And did you notice what it said? Listen again. "So she sat beside the reapers and he served her roasted grain." Guys, this is the only time in all of the Old Testament where the Hebrew word served her, because that's a specific word in the Hebrew, is used. The only time. See, this isn't how it worked. The women served the men in that culture. And so here we have a picture of Boaz serving Ruth. This is not just this is a Moabite woman. And you've just invited her to your table. And not just that, but Boaz is now going to her and serving her at his table. In a very real way, what we have here is the Lord of the harvest, right? Boaz, serving the foreigner, serving the outcast at his table. And we're told here that she ate until she was satisfied. She even had leftovers after she ate. At which point, Boaz then turns and he begins speaking to his employees, to his men there in verse 15. It says, when she rose to glean, Boaz commanded his servants, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not insult her. Also, you shall purposely pull out for her some grain from the bundles and leave it that she may glean, and do not rebuke her. Now again, she's going to be protected. She's going to be provided for, and Boaz is going to make sure of it. Even to his own disadvantage as a landowner, he's saying, take from what's mine and leave it for her to take. And we see the results of this beginning there in verse 17. So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned. So she threshes the grain that she had collected, so all she has left are the kernels. And it was about an ephah of barley. How many of you are still measuring things out by the ephah? Anyone? No? Okay. An ephah is about a half to two-thirds of a bushel. How many of you are still measuring things out by bushels? No? Okay. A bushel is basically about 40 to 50 pounds of grain. Okay? 40 to 50 pounds of grain. Now, just a little perspective here. In ancient Babylonia, because we have writings from there about it, we know that the average ration for a man who was working as a reaper a day, their ration a day was 1 to 2 pounds of grain. Okay? Now, normally, a poor person who would be gleaning in the fields, right, gleaning behind the reapers, they would be excited. They would be ecstatic to get enough for the day, or maybe a little bit for the next day, maybe about a half a pound to a pound of grain. Ruth just walked away with 40 to 50 pounds of grain. And of course, we know that Ruth's a pretty tough woman, right? Because it says she took it up and went into the city in verse 18. So she just, she just straps 40 to 50 pounds on her back and she starts the haul back home. And listen what happens. This is good. Look at the rest of verse 18 there. And her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. I bet she did. Guys, nobody came home with this unless you owned the land. Nobody had this. Can you imagine Naomi's face here? She's been sitting there all day, probably, you know, just hoping that Ruth might come back safe. And that maybe there might be a little food for dinner that night. Maybe if they're lucky, a little bit for the morning. And Ruth comes back hauling 40 to 50 pounds of grain. And this is where I think it gets funny, because verse 18 continues. She also took it out and gave Naomi what she had left after she was satisfied. So not only does Ruth come home with 40 to 50, you know, pounds of grain, and of course Naomi's there with her jaw on the ground, but then Ruth reaches into her back pocket and basically says, oh, and here's some leftovers I had from lunch. It's been a good day, Naomi. It's been a good day. And Naomi, you can imagine, she's ecstatic. Right? She's giddy. Do you remember the last time that we saw Naomi last week? Bitterness. She changed her name from Naomi, which means pleasant, to Mara, which means bitterness, because of what had happened in her life. And now here, she's gone from bitterness to blessedness. The hand of God is beginning to provide for them. And consider this, guys. She's been sitting home all day, probably worrying and fretting about Ruth and fretting about their future. Could it be, guys, that in the middle of our sorrow and in the middle of our suffering, that God might just be plotting for our satisfaction? Is it possible? Could it be that in the depth of your sorrow, in the depth of your suffering, that the God of the universe is right now at this very moment planning your satisfaction? He did for Ruth and Naomi. And so, yeah, Naomi's giddy. In verse 19, of course, then comes the avalanche of questions that you would imagine would come. Look at verse 19. Her mother-in-law then said to her, "Where did you glean today? And where did you work?" I mean, you got to hear it, right? I mean, it's just not the way it sounds on paper. This is the tone. I'm sure it was in her voice. And then she says, "May he who took notice of you be blessed." The words and the questions, the blessings just kind of tumbling out of her mouth. Now, guys, I want us to recognize something here. See, what we realize as readers and hearers from the very beginning is that the best news is yet to come, right? We already know that. We kind of get that. Even if we hadn't read the rest of this book before, even at this point, we know the best is yet to come. I mean, thus far it's been great. 40 to 50 pounds of grain, right? A big old lunch with Boaz and a doggy bag to boot. You know, you have the whole thing going on here, and that's great. But we all know, don't we, that something even better than that is yet to come. Think about this. Ruth knows where she's been working all day, right? In the fields of Boaz. She knows where she's been. But Ruth really has no clue whatsoever as to the significance of Boaz. She doesn't know him from Adam. Whereas Naomi, she knows who Boaz is, but she doesn't know whose field that Ruth has been working in all day long. And so the main piece of information is still yet to be revealed. And the author, very intentionally, makes sure that the name of the man in whose fields Ruth has been working all day is the very last word in the sentence. This author could have been a screenwriter. Honestly. And so what we're all doing, right, as readers of this, we're just kind of excitedly looking at Naomi's face, right? And we're just going, here it comes. Here it comes. Because you think this is good, Naomi. Wait till you hear this. Look at verse 19. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The name of the man with whom I worked today is Boaz." Now, can you picture the look on Naomi's face? She's stunned. And she just kind of blurts out there in verse 20, "May he be blessed of the Lord, who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and to the dead." And again, Naomi said to her, "The man is our relative. He is one of our closest relatives." Now, guys, I want to take just a second here. And I hope it's okay. We're covering a whole chapter, so I'm probably going to go just a little long tonight. I hope that's okay. But there's a couple things I want you to notice here that we're not going to spend a lot of time on, but we are going to come back to them. Next week and the week after. So I want to make sure you notice them now. Two words. Maybe you might even want to circle them. I don't know if you can circle on your iPad, but nonetheless, you know, two words that are worth circling here that we're not going to unpack in depth tonight, but we will in the next few weeks, because these two words are absolutely key to this story. And the first word there in verse 20 is the word kindness. The Lord who has not withdrawn his kindness. Guys, this is a key Old Testament word. It means loving kindness or mercy or grace. And our ears should perk up anytime we hear anything about the grace and the mercy and the loving kindness of God. So circle that word, and we're going to come back to it a little bit more next week. But the second word that I want you to circle is right there at the very end of verse 20. In the NASB, it says closest relatives. Your version might say something different, but this is actually one word. It's two words in English, but it's one word in the Hebrew. And in the Hebrew, this is how it's translated. It's a word you've probably heard before. Kinsman Redeemer. Kinsman Redeemer. You see, in the book of Leviticus, we are given this the very first picture of what this Kinsman Redeemer is. He is a relative, obviously, who is part of a family or part of a clan who would have a right of redemption, a right to purchase, to buy back property maybe that was lost in a debt, or to provide for someone whose family had left them destitute, or someone whose husband had died, for instance. Kinsman Redeemer. Keep that in your mind. We're going to come back to that. But just hold on to those two words. Now continue with me there at verse 21. Then Ruth the Moabitess said, "Furthermore, he said to me, 'You should stay close to my servants until they have finished all my harvest.'" Now, basically Ruth lets Naomi know here that this was not just a one-day gig. This was not just a one-day kind of thing. It was for the entire harvest, for all of Boaz's fields, which, of course, pleases Naomi to no end, right? Provision for food and provision for safety for Ruth. Look at verse 22. Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his maid so that others do not fall upon you in another field." And that's exactly what Ruth does. Verse 23. So she stayed close by the maids of Boaz in order to glean until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. So guys, what this basically means is that for the next 2 to 3 months, okay, day after day after day, Ruth is out harvesting in Boaz's fields. Now, we don't know if she was walking home with 40 to 50 pounds of grain every single day, but the likelihood is that at the end of that 2 or 3 months, Ruth had experienced the provision of God through the kindness of Boaz that would have taken her and Naomi, as far as food goes, probably throughout the entire rest of the year. Completely provided for. And remember, what was one of their greatest needs? Food. And here we see an amazing God-ordained provision. But with all of that action that we have going on here in Ruth 2, you then get to the very last sentence. And it really seems like an incredibly anticlimactic ending to this chapter. I mean, we got all this potential romance and drama and excitement, and then nothing. I mean, it's kind of like you're watching a show. You ever done this, right? You're watching the show and it's getting to the end, right? And all the pieces are starting to come together. You can't wait to see what happens next. And then the screen goes black and it says, "To be continued next week." Right? Don't you hate that? You're like, no! But that's what happens here. Listen to the last phrase there of chapter 2, where the author just simply says, "And she lived with her mother-in-law." Lived with her mother-in-law? Talk about disappointing. I mean, after 2 or 3 months of Ruth working in the fields of Boaz, you would think that maybe something might happen, right? Maybe you're thinking, "Boaz, my man, let's get on. What are you waiting for? She's right there." And remember, Naomi and Ruth's other big problem is still out there, right? Food's been taken care of. Praise the Lord. But their other big problem is still out there. There's still the problem of family. And Ruth is still a Moabitess, as we have been reminded incessantly, you may have noticed, throughout this entire chapter. And she's living with her mother-in-law. Now, talk about a lack of plot resolution. But that's where Ruth chapter 2 basically leaves us. So unfortunately, that's where we're going to stop tonight as well. So what do we have to learn from this, guys? I hope you have a better or maybe renewed appreciation for this book. It really is a beautiful, beautiful book. But what do we take from this? I mean, I really do hope we're not just going to walk out of here and go, oh, what a nice story. Because that's, I mean, forgive me, that's worthless. Right? We want to hear from the Lord. So I just want to take a few moments as we conclude here to kind of show you a picture of God from Ruth chapter 2. And this is one of the things that I love most about this book of Ruth. Because while we do not see God explicitly mentioned in almost every single verse of the book, we do see things like verse 3, and she just so happened. Right? We see stuff like that, which points us to the fact that God is sovereignly working behind the scenes through the characters in the story and through what they're doing. In other words, the characters are ultimately revealing the character of God to us. I mean, God is showing His love to Naomi. How? Well, last week we saw through the radical and absolutely unheard of devotion of Ruth to Naomi, right? God is showing His concern for the poor and for the foreigner. How? By Boaz's concern for the poor and the foreigner. And what we're seeing in the characters in this story is a picture of the character of God. And this isn't, this isn't just some preacher trick, okay? Just to try and make things apply here. This was intentionally done by the author to show us a picture, a glimpse of who God is. And we see that specifically tonight. We see that in the character of Boaz. I want you to think about the things that Boaz does in this chapter. First of all, you notice that Boaz seeks the outcast as his family, doesn't he? I mean, we talked about that more last week, but we see it here again and over again throughout this whole chapter. Right? What does it say? Ruth the Moabitess. Ruth from Moab. Ruth who came from Moab. Ruth who left her homeland. Ruth who, you know, right? Moab, 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 Moab. And we are reminded that she's an outcast. But what's interesting is that when you get to the end of the chapter, even though it still says Ruth the Moabitess everywhere, from all we can tell, it sure looks a lot like she's part of Boaz's family, doesn't it? Doesn't it? I mean, she's working in Boaz's fields. She's having dinner with Boaz at his table. He's even serving her. She's walking home with Boaz's grain on her back. I mean, it sure seems like she's part of his family. But she's still an outcast. She's still a Moabite. And in this, we see that Boaz is seeking the outcast as if it was his own family. A second thing that Boaz does in this chapter that I want you to notice is that he shelters the weak under his wings. And of course, I'm purposely borrowing that language there from verse 12, where it talks about the God of Israel, who under whose wings we've come to take refuge. But the reality is, guys, that Ruth is being protected in this chapter under whose wings? Under Boaz's wings, right? He's the one doing it. It's in his fields and it's under her protection. He's sheltering the weak under his wings, making sure that she's not abused or mistreated or insulted. A third thing I want you to remember that Boaz did here is that he served the hungry at his table. And I really want you to think about that scene again. Because here we have Ruth, right? Traveling back from Moab with Naomi to the land of Bethlehem with absolutely nothing and no one to provide for them. They're just hoping to go out and get a little food for the day, right? That was the best they could hope for. And then all of a sudden, she finds herself sitting at the table and feasting on what Boaz's family is feasting on. And not only sitting at the table, but being served by the Lord of the harvest himself. He serves the hungry at his table here in this chapter. The last thing I want you to remember that Boaz did here is that he showers the needy with grace. With his grace. Right? Day one, she's walking home with 40 to 50 pounds of grain in a doggy bag. I mean, that's pretty amazing. And then day after day after day after day, we see the abundance that is being showered on a very needy Ruth and Naomi with the grace of Boaz. So there's this kind of in a nutshell, the picture of Boaz in this chapter, right? He seeks the outcast as his family. He shelters the weak under his wings. He's serving the hungry at his table, and he's showering the needy with his grace. Now, I suppose at this point we could just stop right here and just be amazed at what a great guy Boaz is. But I want you to see this, because this is exactly how God is seen in Scripture. Exactly. Each of these four things that I just mentioned are the often stated character of God toward you. God seeks the outcast as his family. God shelters the weak under his wings. God serves the hungry at his table. And God showers the needy with grace. Guys, do you believe that about God? I suspect most of us here are going to say, yep, I do. And I believe you. I'm sure that, you know, theologically, biblically, we all believe, yes, that that is in fact who God is. But this truth about God, this picture of God right here, should make us different. Our lives, our actions, our thoughts, our assumptions, our desires, our pursuits in life should all be affected by and informed by these truths about who God is. And I want to show you two ways, just real quick, before we go grab some pie. I want to show you two ways that this should be true in our lives. First, from the perspective of Boaz, who was the one showing love in our chapter, right? And then secondly, from the perspective of Ruth, who is the one who is receiving love in this chapter. First, based on this picture of Boaz. If we believe these things about God that we just talked about, then how we show love means that we will spend our lives for the poor and the outcast. We will spend our lives for those who have little. And guys, don't miss this, please. Because I guarantee you right now, since you kind of know where I'm going with this point, your flesh is going to start tuning me out. Your flesh is going to say, I don't want to hear that. I don't want to do anything of that sort. And you're thinking about, you know, chocolate silk pie or something out there in the lobby. So don't allow that to happen. The purpose of Boaz's concern for this poor outcast girl is to show us God's concern for the poor and for the outcast. Remember, our sovereign God is behind this entire picture, right? Yeah, he absolutely is. He leads Ruth and Naomi back to Bethlehem at a time where his law has set up for them to be provided for. This is Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 18. It says, God defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow and loves the stranger, giving him food and clothing. Ruth, too, is playing that out, isn't it? And Boaz, yes, is the immediate provider here for the poor. But God is the ultimate sovereign provider behind the scenes. And what we're seeing is a picture of what God has ordained his people to be. God has not ordained his people to be accumulation machines. I mean, isn't that often what we are? More, 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 give me more. That's what our culture tells us to do, and oftentimes that's what we want to do in our flesh. But throughout the Old Testament, throughout the New Testament, God has ordained his people to basically be a demonstration of God's radical care for the poor and for the outcast. God has ordained you and I to be a display of how much he loves those who have nothing, how much he loves those that nobody else loves. Guys, this is one of the takeaways we have to take from this chapter. As people look at your life individually, as they look at your family, as they look at us as a church family, as people are reading our story, right, observing our story, do they walk away saying, wow, God has such incredible care and compassion for the poor? Do they get that from us? Now, I'm sure you're aware, right? The poor are just as prevalent and just as needy now as they were when the story was happening. And so it begs the question, are we a visible demonstration of the God who declares that He cares for the poor and loves the outcast? Would we act like Boaz? Would those be our actions? Are we seeking them as our family? Are we sheltering them under our wings? Are we serving them at our table? As those who call themselves the followers of Jesus Christ, guys, we are supposed to spend our lives for what God says is most important. That's what a follower does. And if we will do that, in the process, we are going to be a demonstration of how God feels about the world, His character to the world. Which leads us to the second thing I want you guys to take from this. Don't just stop with the first truth, okay? We are to spend our lives in the benefit, in helping the poor and the outcast, the disenfranchised, the needy. But don't just stop with that first truth, because if you do, you're going to feel exactly as I do, guilty. Right? I'm maybe not doing what I should. And so you kind of feel guilty. So what do you do with a call like that to have the same attitude that God does toward the poor and the outcast? Well, consider this second truth. We can spend our lives for the poor and the outcast because of the truth that we can rest our lives under His protection. In this, guys, what we're seeing God from Ruth's perspective, okay? From the perspective of the one being loved. We will be free to spend ourselves for others when we are convinced that God will take care of us. When we are in that safe place. As long as you and I think that we need more stuff to be satisfied, as long as we think we need more stuff in order to be happy, in order to experience all that life has and all that we want in life, in order to be safe, in order to be protected, as long as we are in a constant pursuit for those things, we will not spend our lives on behalf of the poor and needy. We simply will not do it. Because we're serving ourselves. We're spending it on us. But when the moment comes that we realize that God is who He says He is, that God, that we have everything we need in God, then we are free, you see, from pursuing all of that other stuff and all of the stuff that the world desires, and we are resting our lives under His protection, under His care, under His wings, right? And then and only then will you and I be free to spend our lives for other people. If we do not believe that about God, we will not act like Boaz. We will not do that. Unless you think I'm making too much of this connection, I want you to consider what God says. This is from Isaiah chapter 58. God is speaking here. He says, "No, this is the kind of fasting I want. Free those who are wrongly imprisoned. Lighten the burden of those who work for you. Let the oppressed go free and remove the chains that bind people. Share your food with the hungry and give shelter to the homeless. Give clothes to those who need them and do not hide from relatives who need your help. Then your salvation will come like the dawn and your wounds will quickly heal. Your godliness will lead you forward, and the glory of the Lord will protect you from behind. And then when you call, the Lord will answer, 'Yes, I am here.' He will quickly reply, 'Remove the heavy yoke of oppression. Stop pointing your fingers and spreading vicious rumors. Instead, feed the hungry and help those in trouble. Then your light will shine out from the darkness, and the darkness around you will be as bright as noon. The Lord will guide you, continually giving you water when you are dry and restoring your strength. You will be like a well-watered garden, like an ever-flowing spring." Guys, when we spend our lives for the poor and the needy and the outcast, we have no reason to fear. You do not have to worry, but what about me? See, God's already worrying about you. God's already got you taken care of. Our God says that we will have all that we need, that we will be like a spring whose waters never fail. Do you see the connection here? Rest your life under His protection. Be free from that pursuit of all that stuff that we think will protect us and satisfy us. Now, I understand that that's kind of a scary sounding thing, perhaps. Kind of dangerous, maybe. Kind of risky. But I ask you again, what do you believe about God? Do you believe that God is who we just said He was? Do you believe that God is the one who seeks the outcast as family and shelters them under His wings and feeds them at His table and showers them with grace? Do you believe that that is who God is? If we do, then we can spend our lives for others, for the poor that God says He loves, for the outcast that God says He wants to bring in. See, guys, these two things should revolutionize our lives. And so hopefully, my hope is that we can take a little bit of that from here tonight. And I want to just leave you with the words of Boaz. Okay? You remember what Boaz said to Ruth? He said, "Stay here in this field." And I believe that what God is saying to us is, stay in my field. Stay right here. Stay right here. I'm going to protect you. I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to provide for you. Quit running off to those other fields. Aren't we always doing that? We're running off to those other fields of money and success and materialism. We're running off to other fields of pornography and addiction. We're running off to all these other fields where the world says you're going to be happy if you pursue these things. And what does it do? It does the exact same thing it would have done for Ruth if she went to another field. It leaves us damaged and harmed and empty. So God says, stay. Stay here with me. Come in under my wings. I'm going to give you security. I'm going to give you satisfaction for all your longings. Isn't that what we really want? Isn't that what we really desire from the Lord? Would you pray with me? Father, thank You for tonight. Thank You for Your Word. And I pray, Father, that You would use it in our lives. Change the way we think about things based on who You are, Father. You are a good God. You are a sovereign God. And Lord, You have promised to care for those who belong to You. Father, may we go out of this place tonight living our life as though that were true. May we count important those things You count important. May we spend ourselves, Lord, on the things that You feel are important and necessary. Father, I pray that You would give us the ability to do this. Not just in one small instance, but Father, throughout the entire course of our lives. Giving cups of cold water. Sharing with those who are needy. Sharing our lives with those who have no family. Father, give us Your heart on this. Thank You for Your Word. Thank You for speaking to us tonight. We ask this in Your Son's name. Amen.